Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio and Securing America. We are thrilled to have with us a woman who I consider to be one of the most profoundly important and impactful public intellectuals in America. And she has been for quite some time. In fact, she's won the highly regarded Bradley Prize for this work that she does these days at the Manhattan Institute. She is one of the leading lights at its publications and has been just involved in really all of the most important public policy challenges of our time, and has brought, I think, both an enormous amount of common sense and some extraordinarily impressive research to bear to back up the position she strongly champions on behalf of, well, frankly, every red-blooded American patriot. And I'm very grateful to Heather McDonald, both for all that body of work and for coming to visit with us to talk a bit about it. This has not been easy. She's been extremely patient as we've tried to organize it, and I'm just extremely grateful. Thank you, Heather. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank. And I'm not as peripatetic as you are, so I don't have to deal with all of the connectivity challenges that you do when you're on the road.
I'd like to level set with you on how you would characterize the state of our country at the moment in light of what I consider to be an unprecedented combination of enemies, foreign and domestic, seemingly intent jointly wherever possible to take us down. How do you see it?
Well, I think we're increasingly living lies and we go through little dramatic fictions, theater projects to try and give significance to these lies. One of the most hilarious was the months of barbed wire and bollards and security gates around the Capitol after the January 6th riot, which was, you know, a very serious incident. It should not be underplayed, but it also should not be overplayed. And the government and the media and the Democratic elites were thrilled with this moment because it allowed them to pretend that the biggest threat, domestic or foreign, facing the country was so-called white supremacy and white national terrorism, which is absolutely ludicrous. We had in 2020 the largest single increase, one-year increase in homicide in this nation's history, 30%, which is a statistical change over a year in any context that is mind-boggling. You rarely get that significant, a statistical increase. The bodies dead, an additional thousands and thousands of Black Americans killed by other Black criminals, that's the problem. The number of people killed by alleged white supremacists is a handful. And yet here we were with this pretend that we needed to lock down. And since January 6th, there's been various warnings from the federal government that, okay, it's happening again. It's happening again. Here come the white supremacists. You know, we've got to put the barricades back up, which did happen in September.
It's happening now.
You know, there's going to be
the
some
truck convoy.
Additional Trump riot.
Yeah.
Is it? Are they back?
They're
oh, that's
putting
right,
them back up
for the
right
speech. So all of this is our elites disconnected from reality and foisting on the public a lie. Another lie is the idea that anti-Asian hate crimes, which are on the rise, they're brutal, they're vicious, they're cowardly. You've had in Chicago, in San Francisco, in New York City, frail, elderly Asians who are just pummeled, struck to the ground, stomped on. We're also supposed to believe that that's white supremacists who are doing that. Whereas the video shows it's overwhelmingly black thugs that are beating up on these Asians. And so when we had the Atlanta spa shootings of this young, morally tormented white Christian guy who was in agony of guilt about his sexual cravings, and he opened fire at a massage parlor and sex parlor outside of Atlanta where he'd been soliciting prostitution, that was immediately slotted into the white supremacist narrative. It had nothing to do with race, with ethnicity, with nationality. It was all about his sexual torment. After the Atlanta shootings, he was on his way down to Florida to go after a porn studio. And yet the media ran with this story simply because it allowed them to continue this phony narrative. I see this happening again and again. The overarching, the most fatal narrative that is taking down every institution in our society today is that of systemic racism, whether it's our STEM competitiveness, whether it's classical music, whether it's art museums, whether it's the quality of the federal judiciary, whether it's criminal law standards. Everything is coming down because of the idea that any civilizational, behavioral, or academic standard that has a disparate impact on Blacks is by definition racist. And we would rather pretend that this is a white supremacist country than look head on at the inner city pathology, the pathological culture that is today giving rise to racial disparities. And so as long as the left controls the discourse and the only allowable explanation for ongoing racial disparities is racism, they win. I predict in a few years, we will no longer have a White House. It's going to have to be called something else. I don't know if Washington, D.C. will hold on to its name much longer, but these are these symbolic mob destructions that pretend that Western civilization is the problem. It is not.
Who is behind this? You mentioned the left. To what end are they fracturing our country, turning us against one another, creating these false narratives of our intolerance, our racism, our enmity for one another? Is there some unified field theory as to why this is happening to us at this particular moment in time and at these hands?
Well, I don't think there's a plot. I don't think there's a conspiracy. I don't think anybody's gotten together to map out a strategy. I think these are longstanding ideological currents. The celebration of an oppositional culture that began in the 1960s, the hatred of bourgeois values by the baby boomers who then went on to struggle and, voraciously seek material success and prosperity. But I think that the overwhelming impetus here is the problem of race in America. And I went on recently a Audible listening jag to some of the classics of Black literature, whether it's Man-Child in Promised Land or Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Native Son, Malcolm X, Their Eyes Were Watching God. And what I came away with there is that the conservative narrative about America and race is frankly a little bit of a whitewash. The conservative narrative is we paid our debt with the Civil War, then we passed the civil rights legislation, and it papers over the fact that really the cruel humiliation of Blacks gratuitously continued well into the 1960s, 1970s, in the North as well as the South, something that is so extraordinarily at odds with our founding ideals. So there's a reason why we have a deep well of guilt. That having been said, as unpredicted, unpredictable as it would have been in the 1960s to say that America would do a radical course change, that has happened. While I think that the part of the 1619 Project indictment of the racial divide being baked into the American identity, I mean, when you read accounts by Claude Brown of his treatment in the North, in Harlem, the unnecessary put-downs, there seems to be something about the white identity that needed to offset itself against Black inferiority. That having been admitted freely, we are the opposite of a racist society today. Black privilege is the reality everywhere. There is not a single mainstream institution that is not promoting, hiring Blacks that are less qualified, twisting itself into knots in order to achieve demographic parity and massively lowering academic and job qualifications to do so. America is absolutely ready to be post-racial. What we see is after decades of trying to close the racial gap, there's no progress being made. And I think that the elites are terrified that that gap is not going to close. And they're terrified at alternative explanations to racism, whether it's culture or whether it's heritability. And so they are feverishly putting out there the prophylactically the only allowable explanation for these ongoing disparities. It's true, Blacks are overrepresented in prison. Why? Not because our criminal justice system is racist, but because they commit crime at astronomically, exponentially higher rates than whites and Asians. Blacks die of homicide between the ages of 10 and 34 at 13 times the rate of whites. Why? They're not being killed by cops. They're not being killed by whites. They're being killed by other Blacks who commit homicide at about 13 times the rate of whites. Black violent street crime today, the drive-by shootings, the robberies, is almost exclusively the product of Blacks and Hispanics. Drive-by shootings are not happening in white neighborhoods. If they did, there would be a revolution. Nobody would put up with white children being gunned down in their beds and backyards. The media turns its eyes away because it does not want to. If you talk about Black victims, you have to talk about Black crime, and it's not going to do that. So there are real racial disparities. There are not 13% Blacks at Google. There are not 13% Black partners at Sullivan and Cromwell or Paul Weiss. The reason is not racism. It's the academic skills gap. Black 12th graders read at the average level of the white 8th graders. Black 8th graders, 54%, do not even possess partial mastery of the most basic 8th grade math skills. Those gaps never close. So it is preposterous.
But is the reason why it's such a disparate outcome of these educational systems, as many on the left would have us believe, of systemic racism or an effort to keep Blacks down or otherwise deliberately and purposefully deny them opportunities? Your earlier comments suggest that's not the case, but connect those two dots, if you would.
No, I'm often asked, well, what can we do to close this gap? And I'm sick of the question. There's nothing that, quote unquote, we can do much longer. We have been trying for decades, whether it's massive redistribution of wealth, urban schools are funded on a per capita student basis at much higher rates than suburban schools. Each side has had its own solutions, whether it's charter schools and vouchers on the right or more funding on the left. Both have been tried. I don't know a single wealthy donor in Manhattan, a Republican, who does not have a raft of social uplift programs in the ghetto, whether it's chess, after school programs, tutoring. This has been an obsession of American philanthropy, of American public policy, the idea that we are turning our backs away from this yawning skills gap and culture gap is ludicrous. But at this point, I don't think there's much more that policy can do. The change has to come from within the community. And the most fatal norm that exists in inner city communities now, and that spreads out even into the middle class, is the stigma against so-called acting white. The idea that if you put in effort in your schoolwork, you are simply acting white, and that that's a betrayal of your race. And that prevents people from putting in the necessary effort. I've proposed a thought experiment to assess whether the left's explanation of massive systemic racism is necessary at this point to explain ongoing racial disparities. If Blacks acted like Asians for 10 or 15 years in all things related to economic and academic and life success, if they stayed in school, if they took their textbooks home to study, if they did their homework, if they paid attention in class, didn't beat up on their teacher, didn't join gangs, didn't take drugs, didn't get involved in the drug trade, didn't have children out of wedlock, and we still saw these racial disparities, then it would be time to start talking about systemic racism. But when the behavioral disparities are so large and so patent, it's way premature to invoke this sort of miasmatic explanation of, well, it's just something in the ether that is preventing people from getting ahead, when in fact it is in many cases a lack of a culture that values personal responsibility, deferred gratification, those bourgeois values that Edward Banfield wrote about in the Unheavenly City.
There, again, so much to work through there, but again, brilliantly spoken and courageously so as well. So let me draw you out on a proposition. You say there's no grand conspiracy, and I'm not suggesting it's necessarily a conspiracy, but it does seem to me as though this desire to take down the United States of America as we have known it animates certainly foreign adversaries of this country, ideologically on the left, most of them, communists notably, the Chinese communists most especially, and individuals and front groups and other institutions that have, and I would actually suggest some of those philanthropies that you're talking about, that have made common cause towards this end. And as a result, this idea that the United States is a systemically racist nation seems to, as my friend G. Van Fleet has pointed out, a victim of the Cultural Revolution in Mao's China. This is Maoism. This is a deliberate effort to use not class warfare, but race for this society, which doesn't have so much class as it has had these racial difficulties, as you say. And this is part and parcel of a kind of inside-outside game to fundamentally transform our country. And I just want to go back to what you said, speak to that if you would, but also it seemed to me, Heather McDonald, that when the United States electorate voted for Barack Obama to be the president of the United States, it was in part because not just Black people voted for him, or other people of color, as they say, but white people voted for him as a demonstration that we were in a post-racial era in our country, and that he, it seems to me, through his attacks on the police and his desire, well, as he said himself, to fundamentally transform America, sort of brought us back into this, well, sort of Maoist-prone environment. So your thoughts on those two propositions?
Well, I don't expect our enemies to be in favor of American success. So that's separate. What is unique about this moment, I think, in world history is you have the elites turning on their own culture. And I don't think there's precedent for that. You know, the Chinese Cultural Revolution was the sort of the mob turning on the elites and tearing down academic learning, and professors were pummeled in this leveling instinct. But now you have the elites who are happily embracing the idea that America is incapable of being just, of living up to its ideals of due process and tolerance and equality. And children are being taught that there is nothing good in Western civilization. That's also an experiment. You know, what will happen to those children that have been given nothing to be proud about unless they can grasp on to some sort of victim identity, in which case they will narcissistically, they've got their ticket to success in pretending to be oppressed in this society, which in almost all cases is a complete fiction. I think what we're seeing is a hatred for a civilization deemed too white and too male. Females are taking it down as well. I think that the dominance of the universities by females explains a lot about their radical lurch even further left than anybody would have expected in the 1960s and 1970s. Females are behind the squelching of open discourse there. And our culture, civilization, by demographic necessity, was overwhelmingly created as a European civilization by whites and males. That's just the facts. There wasn't a whole lot of racial and ethnic diversity outside of a very broad category over thousands of years of European history. But it's a lot easier to tear something down than to create anything that can possibly compete with those achievements. So it's a very strange thing. And it makes me sick to see the speed with which our greatest institutions, again, whether it's art or classical music or literature, are all being tarred with this phony brush of racism. And children are being taught they're being given excuse for their own ignorance. Why should they learn about Mozart or Haydn if these are dismissed as simply dead white males? You know, why should they go in an art museum if they're told it's just going to be about silencing voices?
Heather McDonald, we've run out of time long before we've run out of wonderful things to visit with you about. I hope you'll come back. This has been so bracing, and I think that nobody speaks truth to power as elegantly and as compellingly as you do. And as a result, it is, you know, a privilege to have an opportunity to chat. And I know my audience feels the same, and I hope we'll have a chance to do so again in the near future. In the meantime, God bless you, and go forth and multiply, as they say. We'll talk soon. Next up, Robert Spencer joins us. We'll talk about jihad, among other things, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On February 11th, I asked in this space, what is Vladimir Putin thinking? Now we know. After the Russian dictator invaded eastern Ukraine earlier this week, he's channeling another tyrant's calculations of nearly 9 decades ago. Similarities between Adolf Hitler's actions and Putin's recent conduct are striking. An Anschluss, like the Nazis' uncontested occupation of Austria, has lately happened in Belarus. Putin has reprised the Third Reich's brazen seizure of Czechoslovakia's German-populated Sudetenland in the name of ethnic solidarity with his operations in Ukraine's Crimea and Donbass regions. Vladimir Putin now probably calculates that, like Hitler, he can finish the dismembering of the country he's targeted. The Western response, again, has been too little, too late. And most worrying, like Hitler, he has a powerful partner in such crimes. His Stalin is another ruthless communist, China's Xi Jinping. Brace for impact. This is Frank Gaffney.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say, always, that we're joined by Robert Spencer, one of the finest American patriots I have the privilege of knowing personally, and I am delighted that he is one of our senior fellows at the Center for Security Policy, as well as an enormously important contributor to what I think of as the public policy debate in his various platforms, notably as the executive director of Jihad Watch, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and his columns at PJ Media and Front Page Magazine. He is kind enough to visit with us with some regularity, and we're always grateful to have him. Robert, welcome back. If you'll indulge me, Robert, I want to spend just a moment or two memorializing a friend of both of ours, a man that I had the privilege of working with very closely for a number of years and admired tremendously. Early this morning, the United States lost one of its most formidable warriors. Rich Higgins, an Army combat veteran who went on to become a senior civilian national security professional and leading figure in conservative defense and foreign policy circles, succumbed at last to debilitating medical conditions arising from complications of COVID-19. Rich was not merely a physically imposing and intellectually towering figure. His deep knowledge and expertise with respect especially to the nature and practice of irregular warfare made him one of the most important champions our constitutional republic has ever produced. Since most of Rich Higgins' vital work in defending this country from all enemies, foreign and domestic, was done behind the scenes, he is unlikely to get the credit that he never sought, but surely deserves. One exceptional instance that did come to public attention, however, offers an insight into the magnitude of the man's abilities and impact. Rich was an early supporter of candidate Donald Trump and served as one of his campaign advisors and national security surrogates in 2016. After Mr. Trump won the presidency, Rich was among a handful of loyal political appointees brought onto the National Security Council staff. With his background in irregular warfare, Rich Higgins was among the first in the White House complex to understand the magnitude of the problem posed to the Trump presidency by hostile staff members detailed from the federal bureaucracy's so-called deep state, and many others who were actually hired by problematic officials in presidential personnel. He ultimately expressed his grave concerns for the president, his administration, and the country in a document that became known simply as the memo. Tragically, when Mr. Trump favorably received the Higgins memorandum and passed it along to his then National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster for action, the retired Lieutenant General summarily fired Rich and had him perp walk out of the White House complex. The rest, tragically, is history. A history of a presidency sabotaged by enemies within, as well as the concerted, reprehensible conduct of their allies in the media, the Congress, the bipartisan political establishment, and assorted foreign adversaries. To his credit, Rich Higgins continued to serve his president and nation in the years following his departure from government. As an informal presidential advisor, analyst, commentator, and strategist, he contributed mightily to the cause of freedom until his dying breath, inspiring and leading countless others with his profound situational awareness, mastery of the art of war, deep religious convictions, and unflagging patriotism. There would never be a good time to lose a man of Rich Higgins' caliber. That is especially true, however, in our particularly turbulent times. whose ominous portents Rich understood better than just about anybody, and fewer still were better equipped to navigate. He will be sorely missed, particularly by those who will struggle to carry on his desperately needed work despite the huge gap in our line left by his tragic and untimely departure. We can only pray that, as ever, Rich will be calling in plays from his forward position, this time in a far, far better place. So, Robert Spencer, share with us your personal experience of Rich Higgins, the man and the national security force of nature that he was.
Well, you know, Frank, we both know what a great man Rich was. And I think that one of the most important and insightful aspects of his analysis of the establishment in the foreign policy structure, the State Department, the Defense Department, Homeland Security, and so on, is that he recognized to a greater degree than most anyone the alliance between Islamic jihadis, Sharia supremacists, and the left, and how this was a symbiosis that ended up aiding both of them to gain better placement and greater influence within the government. And of course, as you noted, all he got for his pains was to be fired and marched out ignominiously. Meanwhile, those influences continue in the U.S. government, and we're starting to see their devastating effects now.
You know, that's so apt, Robert. And again, it's like so much of Rich's work. I think, you know, there's a special premium to being able to see over the horizon. Most of us can't. And I think Rich, in my experience of him, as you say, was unfailingly looking forward in a way that too few of us normal mortals are capable of. And in particular, being able to assess, you know, what the Islamists in our midst are up to and what the Marxists who make common cause with them, despite their very different, you know, ideological endgames, was really remarkable. And I learned so much from him over the years and watched him have, as I say, an outsized impact on the sorts of things to which he put his mind. And we will sorely miss him, that is for sure. And I just wanted to say to you, Robert, and to our audience, thank you for letting us take a minute to reflect on this great American and to mourn his passing. Let me turn to a topic that is also a pretty weighty matter. Robert Spencer, you, of course, are watching very closely and I think doing a superb job of analyzing what is happening across our northern border. The title of the national anthem of Canada, Oh Canada, has never seemed more apt, I think, at the moment. Give us your sense of what has happened to the government of Canada and what it portends both for its people and perhaps as a model for other parts of what we think of as the free world, including perhaps our own.
Like Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, has invoked the Emergencies Act, which is designed for, as it is clear, emergencies. And he has tried to portray the Freedom Convoy of truckers who have been demonstrating in Ottawa for the last few weeks, he's trying to portray them as being not only in violation of the law, but also as racist, anti-Semitic, neo-Nazi, white supremacists. I think it's telling that he has falsely claimed that the protests were not peaceful. They were among the most peaceful protests that we've ever seen in recent years, in sharp contrast to the Antifa and Black Lives Matter protests from a few years back. And he, in defaming the protesters as neo-Nazis and claiming this was not peaceful, he has taken drastic action in invoking the Emergencies Act, which enables him to seize the bank accounts of the protesters. Now, this is something that everybody who understands the importance of a free society should be up in arms about, figuratively, Frank, because the Emergencies Act was supposed to be a matter of wartime or some other tremendous crisis. And for Trudeau to unleash it against his enemies while relentlessly smearing and defaming them, he's just trying to use it to silence his opposition and marginalize his opposition, a very effective protest that had a lot of sympathy among Canadians and people worldwide. And so this is an extraordinarily important moment in world history, in that Canada is in grave danger of becoming an authoritarian dictatorship. This is not an exaggeration. The Emergencies Act gives Trudeau powers to suspend civil liberties without warrants, without legal action, and so on. And there's no telling when it's ever going to stop. Since it's already been based on false pretenses, that should have been something that makes everyone stand up and say, this must not stand. The Trudeau government must fall. The Emergencies Act must be rolled back. But I think few people understand the grave implications of what's happening.
Robert, that's an extremely articulate as well as damning indictment of the Trudeau government. And I think you're absolutely right on. What I have found is that what we're watching, not just in that nation, but others of what's been called the Anglosphere, Canada is, of course, an important part of it, but so is Australia and New Zealand, and to some extent Great Britain as well, have been subjected to a kind of tyranny associated with these COVID-19 mandates, lockdowns, passports, mandates of other kinds, what have you. It's stunning to me, Robert, how fast this has occurred in each of these countries, and it seemingly, well, comprehensively, but possibly even irreversibly so.
Yes, that's true. It seems as if it's hard to escape the impression that the whole thing has been coordinated, that people who are against the basic principles of free society are using the COVID pandemic in order to advance their agenda. And so many people have been wrong-footed by this because they don't recognize what's happening. And they don't realize that they don't realize what's at stake. But when New Zealand and Australia and Britain and Canada all move in the direction of authoritarianism all at once, it seems very, very strange. And it may be that this is something that is being coordinated somewhere. Many people have pointed out that a lot of the officials from these various countries are all members of the World Economic Forum. I don't know if that is the root cause of all this, but there's no doubt that the World Economic Forum has published material that is very far to the left. Most notoriously, an article a few years back saying in 2030, you will own nothing and have no privacy and you'll be happy. And it seems like now we have the Anglosphere moving in that direction.
It certainly does. And to the extent we are moving in that direction, the we, I fear, is extending possibly here as well. You're tracking very closely, I know, developments in terms of, you know, the homeland security of this country, as well as others in the free world. Robert Spencer, are you concerned about some of these things manifesting themselves here as well? And if so, to a similar end?
Oh, absolutely, Frank. Look, I think if we had a real president in the White House right now, he would be denouncing Canada and announcing sanctions against Canada, not just against Russia regarding Ukraine, but against Canada for trampling upon the civil liberties of its citizens. And this is, after all, the land of the free and the home of the brave. If the United States doesn't stand for freedom, who's going to? And yet, this is not on the horizon, of course. It does look as if it's been widely speculated, in any case, that the Biden administration wants to do much the same thing. Now, we can be thankful that We don't have an Emergencies Act here in the United States, but there's always a way to find some legal workaround if you try hard enough. And I think that the Biden administration is warmly sympathetic to what Trudeau has done and would love to replicate it here.
Robert, I'm fearful that there are, unfortunately, provisions in our U.S. code that are susceptible to this kind of abuse as well. And if it is the case that they're there, I have the feeling this administration will be doing its level best to try to take advantage of them. So thank you for raising the alarm on that. And I hope that our concerns about what's happening elsewhere in the Anglosphere, as it's called, to say nothing of other parts of the free world, will be subject to corrective action before they take a possibly irreversible turn. Let me turn to one other topic, though, with you in this regard. Robert, we have, as you know, a considerable number of individuals who I describe as Sharia supremacists in this country. I don't think that they're the majority of Muslims, but that's a somewhat subjective judgment. But I am very concerned about the infusion of what may be a rather large cohort of such individuals who believe that Sharia law, not our Constitution, ought to be governing in America, and who are willing to engage, as you've documented so magnificently in your myriad books, a practice commanded by Sharia, namely jihad, to try to bring that state about. Namely, this very large number of Afghan refugees, it seems the vast majority of whom we've admitted into this country without adequate vetting, and despite the fact that they are military-age young men in many cases, and therefore particularly potentially dangerous. Your thoughts on what's been done in that regard to date, and what we're hearing about them being insinuated into communities all over this country with, again, as best I can tell, no proper vetting as to what that might mean for those communities.
There hasn't been proper vetting. The Republicans in Congress actually submitted a report detailing the failures of the vetting process and the fact that there are criminal and terrorist databases that were not consulted in Qatar when the Afghans passed through there. They were just raced on, hurried over to the United States. And thousands of them are, well over 100,000 actually, are now being resettled in communities all over the country. Now, even aside from the vetting, there's a huge problem, and that is the cultural problem. For example, at Quantico Marine Base, one of the Afghans who was there, he was arrested for sexual assault of a three-year-old girl. He was absolutely nonplussed when he was arrested because he said that what he did was perfectly acceptable within his culture. And that's absolutely true, as a matter of fact. The Bachabazi is well known. The sexual abuse of young boys in Afghanistan, and to its everlasting shame, the U.S. military was told to ignore that in our dealings with our putative allies while the American troops were in Afghanistan. Now these people are coming over here, and this sort of behavior is coming here with them. Another incident came out of Wausau, Wisconsin recently. There was another Afghan who had become a darling of the media, and he had been interviewed in the local press several times, speaking about the difficulties of being a refugee, his gratitude to the United States, and so on and so on. And then it turned out that he was actually also arrested for sexual assault of one of the people who was working on resettling him in the Wausau area. And here again, this is probably something that he had no idea there was anything wrong with this, because a woman who's not veiled, who's uncovered, the Quran says in chapter 33, verse 59, that women should veil themselves so that they're not molested, with the implication being, the other side of that, that they can be molested if they're not covered.
Yeah, it's fair game. Robert, again, this is horrific as far as it goes, but to the extent that it may go considerably further than this, that their cultural norms or their sense of entitlement or their belief in God's direction pursuant to passages of the Quran that you're very familiar with may prompt them to take advantage of these opportunities to inflict incalculable harm on people, perhaps en masse, is deeply worrying. And I have to ask, what in your best reconstruction of the events was going on when these individuals were being rushed through Qatar? Was it simply that they'd had to get them out of there, having mistakenly brought them from the, the Kabul airbase, and they couldn't leave them in Qatar because the Qataris weren't going to have them, or was it, some other purpose, including, the belief that it's important to have such people in our country on the part of some in government of the United States? It seems unimaginable, but it's another possible explanation. Your thoughts?
I think that's very likely, Frank, that the idea of a dependent class that would rely on the government for its welfare would not be able to speak English for the most part. This is something that's very attractive to a lot of the people who are in power now, because these people reliably vote for them. And it's noteworthy that in Loudoun County, Virginia, recently, there was a notice that thousands of refugees would very quickly be descending upon the community, be sent by the government into Loudoun County. And the sheriff there said, "Who are these people?" And the government officials said, "Oh, they're translators." But 70% of them don't speak English. So it's a kind of an odd kind of translator. And it shows that there's a lot of dishonesty and deception at the highest levels about this whole process.
I'm wondering whether, Robert, and we have to let you go, but whether in Loudoun County, among other places, an area I'm pretty familiar with, we have an infrastructure of Islamists that would be very welcoming of their numbers being increased in this way. And perhaps that's it's not an accident, as they say, why they've been made a destination for such an infusion. But this is a topic to which we will return with you on another occasion soon, I hope. Robert Spencer, thanks for the great work you do at Jihad Watch and with us at the Center for Security Policy. We really appreciate you. We look forward to our next conversation. I look forward to my next chat with the rest of you as well. Of course, tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. So it begins. As predicted in this space, now that China's genocide games are complete, Vladimir Putin has launched his long-planned invasion of Ukraine. It turns out not to be a minor incursion. Rather, the Russian dictator has clearly, by prearrangement, recognized the independence of two Ukrainian provinces in the Donbas region and moved so-called peacekeeping forces in to begin the process of annexing them to Russia. This is unlikely to be the extent of what might be called the not-so-great reset. In a speech yesterday forcefully denouncing the legitimacy of Ukraine's sovereignty, Putin made plain that his ambitions extend to the whole of that country. In the absence of the needed credible deterrence by the United States, we must expect, moreover, that Putin's communist Chinese allies, and perhaps others, will seize the opportunity for aggression as well. That will end badly. This is Frank Gaffney. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On February 11th, I asked in this space, what is Vladimir Putin thinking? Now we know. After the Russian dictator invaded eastern Ukraine earlier this week, he's channeling another tyrant's calculations of nearly 9 decades ago. Similarities between Adolf Hitler's actions and Putin's recent conduct are striking. An Anschluss, like the Nazis' uncontested occupation of Austria, has lately happened in Belarus. Putin has reprised the Third Reich's brazen seizure of Czechoslovakia's German-populated Sudetenland in the name of ethnic solidarity with his operations in Ukraine's Crimea and Donbass regions. Vladimir Putin now probably calculates that, like Hitler, he can finish the dismembering of the country he's targeted. The Western response, again, has been too little, too late. And most worrying, like Hitler, he has a powerful partner in such crimes. His Stalin is another ruthless communist, China's Xi Jinping. Brace for impact. This is Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
Remember the Alamo, was the cry of the Texas Army. The battle began today, February 24th, 1836, when 3,000 Mexicans attacked 182 Texans. Within 13 days, all defenders were killed, including Davy Crockett and James Bowie. The Texas Declaration of Independence stated, General Antonio Lopez Santa Anna, who, having overturned the constitution of his country, now offers as the cruel alternative either abandon our homes or submit to the most intolerable of all tyranny. He denies us the right of worshiping the Almighty according to the dictates of our conscience.
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.